As we mentioned, that rupture of Line 6B in 2010 gave many in Michigan reason to fear another pipeline leak. But there are still others who think the science isn't being represented properly and the fears are overblown. Just what do we know about the construction of these pipelines? And what should we understand about how they're made and used and maintained? Let's turn now to Richard Kuperwitz, who's president of AccuFacts. Good to have you on the program, Richard.
Good day.
Tell us about your background and what capacity do you work in the pipeline industry?
Usually brought in to investigate incidences lately in the last 10 or 15 years. I've got over 40 years experience, the majority of it with pipelines, and I've represented both pipeline companies, the public, local governments. They usually bring me in to try to be a neutral party, make sure they're asking the right questions, and more importantly, the answers to those questions are being answered truthfully and factually.
Here in Michigan, certainly, as I mentioned, there's much attention focused on Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac and the fact that they're over 60 years old. Does that age concern you?
No, it doesn't. And I'm probably closer to those lines than the average person. I was actually out there when scuba divers checking the condition of the line, and they weren't for Enbridge personnel. They were for other parties. But the age of pipelines and transmission service like these are isn't really a leveraging factor because even steel of over 100 years ago, pipe steel does not wear out. It isn't like an automobile engine. The real factor on pipe steel, this is a very important distinction, is what we call the vintage. Depending on how the pipe was made and what its specifications were and the various processes used to make the pipe, there can be various different types of threats depending on the vintage of the pipe.
So it's the vintage and not the age.
That's correct. And the vintage we usually use to screen for certain different types of threats that can be attributed to the vintage of certain pipe steels that could result in pipeline failure. Ironically, even new pipe steel, if it isn't respected appropriately, can actually fail quicker than some of the pipelines that are 100 years old. It's just an ironic situation.
Interesting. So what's the main cause of pipeline failure?
Depending on which database you go look at, you'll get a lot of different stories. In some cases, I think people are trying to be honest in their answer. In other cases, they're trying to spin another agenda. But we tend to see in liquid transmission pipelines, like the Line 5, corrosion tends to be still a leading, if not the major cause of pipeline failure. There are some people who will say third-party damage is the leading cause of pipeline failure. But for liquid transmission pipelines in the United States, we don't think that's an accurate statement.
How has the science of corrosion in pipeline steel, how has that changed or evolved in the decades that you've been in the business, Richard?
Especially in the 60s, the technologies to protect against external corrosion as well as internal corrosion took quantum leaps in our scientific understanding. In parallel with that, and since the, I'll say roughly the 70s, the tools to use for inline inspection of transmission pipelines, if they can use these devices, and these are multi-ton devices that are inserted and flow inside a operating pipeline, specially designed for a particular type of threat, especially in the area of corrosion, have advanced considerably since, I'd say, the mid-70s. And in the last 10 or 20 years, the accuracy and reliability of corrosion inspection tools have advanced considerably. However, despite that, corrosion still tends to be the leading cause of transmission pipeline failures. So you can have a good tool, but use it unwisely.
What can you tell us about what happened with the Kalamazoo River pipeline with that rupture? Were they able to identify what kind of corrosion that was?
Yeah, it was two specific types of corrosion. This is in the public domain.
Right.
The NTSB has got a lot of information on this. That's a government agency that actually takes their obligations to investigate when they're triggered to investigate a pipeline failure very seriously, and they have an excellent process to try to maintain their objectivity and neutrality, so I really support their efforts. There was a fairly serious, what we call general corrosion wall loss. In other words, external corrosion caused the pipe wall to thin, and then on top of that, they had a very specialized type of corrosion called stress corrosion cracking, which is an environmentally type form of corrosion, a specialized form of corrosion that on top of the general walls, they can cause cracks to occur in the pipe that penetrated the existing remaining pipe wall. And so it got to a certain thickness of pipe steel from these two types of corrosion, and it went to failure at a very low operating pressure.
When you investigate a pipeline break, let's move away from the Kalamazoo River one and just talk in general. What are you looking at, Richard Cooperwitz, when you go in to investigate the material?
We follow a general process step that has various baskets that we look at. And the first thing we'll tend to zero in on is if it has a remote controlled system, a SCADA, what we call a SCADA, where they remotely monitor their pipeline. We'll look at that operation as one basket of interest. And then we'll look at things like the pipe material, you know, how it's operating, what's the environment, where is it located. And then we'll investigate various management processes to see if the pipeline company is actually understanding, you know, what their responsibilities are. And more importantly, are they exceeding certain minimum standards like the federal regulations?
What's more important in your view, the material or the company's maintenance of that pipeline?
Both. Mm. I can't give you an answer to saying that they're of equal value. It depends. They'll swing from one to the other. You can have the best steel in the world, and if you don't respect it in the wrong environment, it's not going to last very long.
That word you used really jumps out at me about respecting that material.
That's right, because you know these are pipelines that by their very nature are moving hazardous liquid. And so when they're released, they're sure it can be damage to the environment, but there also can be very serious threats to public safety. And so I don't fear this material. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of pipeline companies, and I won't name them because I don't want to jinx them, but there are pipeline companies who understand their roles and responsibilities and stay well ahead of minimum federal regulations on pipeline safety.
So looking back at what happened with Line 6B and looking at all the reports, what went wrong there?
In most of these massive releases and failures like this, there's morally, I've never seen a single event failure in my 40-plus years of investigation. It's a whole series of failures. And if you were to look and read in detail the public NTSB report, you're going to find that there were failures on many levels, on many fronts, in many areas of that operation.
Hmm.
And so, again, I'm not here to belittle or badger the operator who is Enbridge Pipeline, but it's just when you read the report, it's just downright embarrassing.
Hmm.
And that's not a place I want a pipeline company to be at.
How do we as the public know whether a company is doing what you know they should be doing, respecting the material, maintaining those pipelines, and that it's telling us the truth about that?
Well, that's a fair question, and it's difficult. First of all, it's not that technically challenging. This isn't rocket science. Right? But I would suggest to people, look for consistency, and you know this word that came out a couple years ago, is it truthfulness?
Truthiness.
That's the word. So if an operator with a good story respect that they cannot disclose everything about their pipeline, okay? But what they do disclose ought to be factual, truthful, and consistent. If they're caught in too much PR spin, it's hard to maintain their stories. And so you'll see inconsistencies in some of the way they deal with problems. If the public sees that, and I've been in investigations where they clearly recognize that fairly quickly, the operator loses considerable credibility. And so that's, again, I'm not there to put a label on any particular company, but that's the thing I constantly warn operators about. We understand you can't disclose everything to the public, but what you tell them, if you've got a good story, you should be able to tell them the truth.
In the last minute we have, Richard, we need pipelines because we need oil. There's no way around that. What do you think is the most important way to ensure that these pipelines stay safe and do the job they're designed to do?
Well, I think the operators need to comply and exceed the minimum federal regulations governing these things. And then there needs to be some sort of way, and we're still working on that, but how do you get certain key information into the public's hands in a manner that is able to demonstrate that the operator has their operation under control? You know, trying to prevent the public from knowing certain type of information that's very important to gaining the respect of the operator under national security claims are way overblown.
Giving us the engineer's take on these pipelines, Richard Cooperwitz, president of AccuFacts Incorporated. Richard, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you.